Very nice question here to deal with. A chap opens a claim, and we deal with it in the second half, and we'll carry on with the thing we've just started from fair to bound. Memory, where it is stored. First of all, we have to remember that the word itself, today I'm going to bridge off to the brother, the word itself implies a substance being differentiated and affirmed. You affirm the differentiations of the substance. The O in it is the zone, the M in it, double, represents the frequencies within that zone, and to see all the differences arising from the vibrations of this zone and to affirm them, to make them firm, bring them up a bit, is to remember. Memory is that storehouse in the substance of formal vibrations which constitute together with all their relations and intersections the sum total formal content of the absolute. But when we remember, we make again a member, and this means that we have already, by using the word again, we have an individuality here, and this individuality is basically a sphere. The sphere contains in its vibrations all the formal activities that constitute, when serialized, all that that being may know in time. But prior to serialization, each such being is a wisdom sphere, a sphere of total knowledge held non-serially. And because each being is such a sphere, and the geometry of all spheres is the same geometry, then every being is basically as wise as every other being. Now what, then, makes a difference between the memory of one being and another? The answer can only be that when these spheres come together, they strike upon each other and make the contingent stimulus. And the character of this stimulus has resonance relations with some of the totality of form within. So that the stimulus itself is like the hammer, and the whole sphere is like the bell. And the size of hammer you use, and the texture of the hammer, and the number of repetitions, and the vibrations of the hammer, determine what is going to be superstressed in the wisdom and become a content of consciousness in a now, in the temporal series. Temporality depends upon the contingent stimulus. Eternality depends on the whole being simultaneously being itself. Every being knows the modifications of its own substance. If it were not for the external stimulus, every being would be wise in the cosmic universal sense, and all beings would know exactly the same thing, and they would know it simultaneously. Now, if we try to think of where memory is stored, we will be driven back to consider that it must be stored in the field of power itself. Because we know that matter, so-called particles, atoms, electrons, protons, etc., are simply modalities of force. And therefore the human brain is a modality of force, and the particular locatable rotations of force, the primary particles, are what they are only because of the behavior of the field. So the field is absolutely the storehouse of all memory. Now, if we get a particular being, an individual with a brain, and we start beating the brain from outside with hammers or electric shocks, or we get mad and cut bits off it, we are not interfering with the formal content of the field, but we are interfering with that part of it, that modality of it, that can come into contingent relation with another one. One of these spheres may represent a scientist with a surgical bias, and the other sphere, a patient. The scientist gets his knife and cuts a bit off the patient's brain. And then erroneously thinks that he's cut off a portion of his memory. He hasn't. He's cut off a portion of his contingent stimulus value to the scientist. So that in effect he puts himself out of relation with the patient and is then himself the cause of the lack of communication, which he calls the destruction of the patient's memory. Factually, the patient and the center of the patient, the self, is aware of the transcendent field when he introverts onto center, but when he turns to the outside contingent field, he will find something is missing, namely where the surgeon put his knife. But all that's been removed is a means of communicating with the external world. Nothing has been removed from the essential self. This is why the Bhagavad Gita says knives cannot cut it, flames cannot burn it. The field itself, being a continuum, cannot be affected by any finiting processes within it. And the finiting processes are individual. There is a term for this cosmic memory, Mahatishvara itself, and you can see that the word is made of the word for substantial activity, the crossing or crucifying of forces, further activity, differentiations, an old gift for a man and the Lord, a point issuing fire, going along and mobilizing. The whole word tells you that there are motions going along, spreading out, differentiating, producing points, differentiating the points, energizing them, fixing them, and establishing them in substance. Now that is cosmic memory. And an individual human being, regarded as a form with the stress of the gross matter, the food is eaten, is simply one of the form contents of this Mahatishvara, the cosmic memory. And that cosmos is a big sphere, and its geometry is exactly the same as any small sphere. So the macrocosmos, the little cosmos, represented the little circle, is inside a big macrocosmos, and every line in the macrocosmos goes through the microcosmos, so the geometry of both is identical. And consequently, by introvert meditation upon the sphere of one's own being, arises knowledge of the macrocosmic being, because they are identical, they are both spheres, and the totality of forms of all spheres is identical. So that an individual man, by self-knowledge, learns exactly the same thing that he would learn if he had total cosmic awareness. If we call this total cosmic awareness the mind of Christ, then any individual who understands himself and his own processes has the mind of Christ. And the same relation exists between the mind of Christ and such a balanced individual as exists between a very large musical instrument and a very small one, where the octave blown on one of them will cause a resonance as another octave on another one. It's the same note, doubled up so many times, and they're in harmonic relation, all the formal content of the one is reflected into the other. So then we say memory is stored in the field. So there is an absolute memory, the memory of the absolute field, because that field is power. Power cannot be static as such, and consequently the concept of the static cannot be applied to it. Therefore the absolute must be conceived to be in absolute motion, and the absolute motion contains all possible conceivable finite motions in simultaneity. And in this simultaneous co-presentation of all possible motions, the absolute, one of them is the motion of the largest spherical concept, and that is the universe, the macrocosmos. So we have the absolute one that transcends all differentiation whatever, and then the biggest finite one, we have the macrocosmos, and then in terms of this, very small spheres, of which in the Middle Ages and about the alchemical period of symbology, man is termed a microcosmos, a little cosmos. Gurdjieff increases the number of cosmic beings and refers to Megalo cosmos and so on. But this is just saying that it's a bigger circle and a bigger circle and a bigger circle. Until we get head up, we look at the bigger circle. in infinite space, we could go on, given infinite time, conceiving bigger circles. We wouldn't get any wiser because all these circles are geometrically the same. So if we can understand the geometry of one sphere, we've understood the geometry of all spheres. And if we understand the geometrical possibilities of our own sphere, the macrocosmic sphere, we understand that as a macrocosmic sphere. And therefore the old saying, there is nothing outside the man which is not inside the man. And what is not inside the man is nowhere. Memory is stored in the field, and differentiation of memory comes from contingent stimulation of finite zones of the field striking upon each other on their perimeters. The field is vibrating, and the vibrations are initiated throughout the field at any point whatever. And spreading from that point, as they go out, they strike upon other centers, and this striking upon another center constitutes, for the receiving center, a contingent stimulus, which is a hammer striking on its bell. And according to the nature and angle and frequency of the incoming stimulus, so the receiving being has superstressed within itself a particular form, which it then says it has perceived, if for the first time, and if for the second time it remembers. So surely that will do, because if we try to reduce memory down to the material brain, we come up against quite stupid self-contradiction. If we take the 19th century concepts of the human brain, it's made of molecules which are made of atoms. They got a bit stuck. And even if they'd come down to subatomic particles, the primary particles that Pearson talks about, even if we had that, we'd have to draw one particle like a billiard ball. Now, if that billiard ball, that particle, really exists in space and is other than energy, straight away there's absolutely no method of engramming anything upon it, other than engraving it. If that is a billiard ball and you want to put information on it, you'll have to get a sharp tool and engrave upon it. It's a terribly crude image, which is the kind of image that was used, saying somehow the mind is engraved by some kind of thing. The tool is the stimulus, leads to the marks. One of the proofs they thought was that the child's brain is smooth, the adult's brain is wiggling like this. All these wiggles are the product of stimuli hitting. Therefore they're being engraved. Now it's true that the change takes place from smooth to convoluted form, yes? And it's true that energies come in from outside. But it is not true that that brain is made of ultimate billiard balls waiting to be engraved. The reason these convolutions appear is to make room for the data that are coming in terms of the brain as a dynamic system of forces. It convolutes to increase its surface area. It's increasing the surface area so that particular zones of its vibration can be kept separate from others. So it only grows, increases convolutions according to the need of the incoming stimulus situation. Every stimulus that comes in is received from within by a command, make room for it. This you experience by the fact that you can, if you're annoyed with somebody, close your mind too. So that even if they tell you a known truth, you can shut down on the truth, you can hear it beat you, and you can reject it. You can keep yourself tight against it. You can refuse to expand your feet. When you do that, it just doesn't go in. You can reject keeping suppression part of your wisdom because it's associated with a person you don't like. Perhaps somebody says something to you, it's a very good idea, and you haven't thought of it before, as far as you know, in the time process. But you don't like the man who said it, so you won't admit that you know it, even though you know that you do know it. So you suppress it. Put the energy contract on it, and it can't spread out and become conscious knowledge. You get it from the wrong person. Obviously, the man who wants to get wrong, she doesn't care where he gets it. But it's the hammer that can strike my bell. That might be enough for the storehouse of memory. The storehouse of memory is the absolute power, continuum itself. It is called the substance when we understand it as standing underneath any particular perceptual group. But that substance is not matter. Substance is power. So M is H. Substance is H viewed as spatial pillar, pillar of the void. And form is the differentiation of the substance. And power is the concept we have when that substance is mobilized as motion. So we get the triad of the H, M, N. That is motion of the power, and the motion when it rotates makes the substance, and further entrance of power moves it more and more and more until we get a trinity of substance, power, form in every being. So to increase memory power, we have to increase one or two things. Either the rate of external stimulation, and the width of the field of external stimulation, by studying all the related scientists' works simultaneously, or we have to cut down on contingent stimulation so that we don't have a superstress, and then we rediscover the sphere of wisdom in its wholeness and its continuous nature. Those are the two processes. One of them, the Western process, says increase the contingent stimulus. So we say that the west of a person is the perimeter, and the east of a person is the center. The Western man has gone following the setting sun, he's gone to the west, and the Eastern man has gone towards the rising sun, the Orient. The center of a being is called the mystical east. You notice the letter for it is the E, which is the Hebrew He, the glyph of cosmic awareness. If you drive into the center and allow contingent stimuli to lapse, and don't be diverted by them, and don't get supersets put upon you by contingent stimuli with the ladies or gentlemen, when you go into the center, then you discover the cosmic field. The superset being taken up, you gain cosmic awareness, the short one. That's called the high road. The other way is called the low road. And whichever way is going, you'll finish up in the same place. Scotland. And if you go the low road goers claim they'll be there before the high road goers. And this historically is a fact. For the generality, but it is not a fact for individuals. In the Orient, yogis and sages have gone east, and they've got there before the West. But because they've got there, they have detected the dialectical self-contradiction of wielding individual power. As soon as they discover they are the absolute, they have no ground for declaring an individual war. And so they've literally done nothing about it. Because to be aware of the absolute is to behave like the absolute does, namely, to behave like nothing at all. So those sages who have attained that mystic east haven't been able to advertise on the TV about it and let everybody know their attainments. But the fellows who've gone west along the low road to Scotland, they've invented the H-bomb. They claim to have attained power before the men that have gone east. They have attained violence on the perimeter, but the other men didn't aim at that. But because they have this power of inflicting contingent violence on other beings, they feel, for the time being, very powerful. Some of the more enlightened ones in the West are even beginning to see that power refutes itself, that we can make weapons so big we can't let them off. We have to limit the size of the weapons that we could make, otherwise we will blow ourselves out of existence. And at this point, the West has refuted itself over the long course, whereas the East refuted itself over the short course. Hard meditation would convince any man that if he wants power and wishes to rule, the concept of rulership here, the Rosh or head concept, implies that down here is the ruled, the differentiated, tied together in their divisions, so that the man who sees the differentiation possibilities here, if he wants to rule and keep them in order, will have to do a very stupid thing. He'll have to give them what they want. Otherwise they won't be ruled, they'll revolt. So that if he actually does become a great Rosh, a great head, he started by wanting to be a big head in the first place, but when he gets there, Makroprosopos is the title of the divinity, the old big head, when he gets there, he discovers he's got to feed everybody. He's got to arrange for the distribution of all the foods of the earth and all the raw materials and all the necessary refrigerators. So, if he wishes to stay at the top, he'll have to start being decent. So that the whole concept of shining and putting on your brass helmet and driving up one-way streets the wrong way and things like that has to be realized as no good. There comes a point where, if you are ruling, you have to bend the knee to the ruled. Otherwise they don't like it. Now those who went east, the great sages, saw this a long time ago. So they said, if ruling means that we will have to consider the rule, better to reject the rulership and let them consider us. And so there's a pilgrimage to the great sages, but there's no pilgrimage to the great brass hats. And this again is a dialectical opposition. Those who went east discovered the flaw in going west, only they discovered it quicker. Those who went west took a long, long time to discover the self-reputation of the west, and at our stage of evolution, they're running in as fast as they can to the ecumenical councils and other kind of things, wondering if they can't turn the tables and suddenly go east and become decent types. And in the case of the most advanced political builders in the world, whose name shall not be mentioned, we find them indulging in moral propaganda now and representing themselves as the spiritual leaders of the world, who have been called in the past a perfidious white serpent. If you have enough energy, you can go in and discover the refutation of an act within an hour or two. If you haven't, for years you will be hammered along the low road until you do. But funnily enough, it requires as much energy to drive into that center as it takes to go along the low road over years. So it means you actually have to get as many nervous impulses as it would take you to be hammered over 20 or 30 years and compress them into 20 or 30 minutes if you want to get into the east. Because the east and the west, the perimeter and the center, are exactly balanced. It's a system of equilibrium of forces, so that whatever you save on the roundabouts, you will have to expend on the swings. We then come to this second part here, which is related to it, which is the correct content for the idea expressed in "Do unto others as you would have done unto yourself." This seems meaningless when taken in a general sense, because the verb "do" implies there has been a conscious choice, and not just a reciprocal feeling, feeding on comforting platitudes and actions. If the development of ourself depends on affirming that which is negated in us, and this is a troublesome process, then wishing this on others has surely quite other implications to those usually associated with this phrase. I thought that was a point, but that's all right. Now, do unto others as we would do unto ourselves. And this statement says, if I am prepared to hammer myself to the center, then I'm quite legitimate to hammer other people into the center. Because I'm doing unto them what I want to do to myself. That's consistent. But when I'm hammering myself into the center, I'm always aware of tremendous resistance. And consequently, if I try to hammer another person into the center, I'm sure that they will have a similar kind of resistance in themselves, plus another one, namely resistance to the contingent stimulus which I represent to them. When I hammer myself in, at least I know I'm doing it. But when I hammer somebody else in, they don't know why. It's a contingent stimulus. Now there's absolutely nothing at all against hammering other people into the center providing you would hammer yourself into center in the same situation. And you are not in the same situation if you are identified with your finite physical body. Your finite physical body, your so-called individuality, individuality of form, that finite body has a certain number of disequilibria inside it. And these are so uncomfortable that they drive you to want to eliminate the unbalance. The unbalance in you makes you want to make balance. And you start work upon it, and you drive in, examining yourself as you go. But the peculiar thing is here. If you are identified with your individuality, you have only an individual superstress memory. Because you are superstressed in this way, you haven't got the information about another individual superstressed in another one. So that in effect, when you say, do unto others as you would do to yourself, it means do unto identical beings the same. All those beings that are identical in every way can be treated in the same way. But if you can't establish that the other being is identical with you, then you certainly cannot treat him as if he were. So insofar as another being has unknowns in him, you cannot deal with him on the basis of what you know about yourself. So that when you try to accelerate the development of another being because you're accelerating yourself, and of course you don't want to be lonely, because if you get to heaven first and there's nobody there, it's going to be just awful. So the tendency to accelerate other people is really a product of the fear of loneliness when you get to heaven. If you examine it very carefully, you'll find that the desire to accelerate other people has to do with the fear of isolation. Because if you can imagine yourself becoming perfect and nobody else becoming perfect, you immediately feel isolated if you don't understand that perfection is not an individual finite state at all. Perfection is identification with the absolute. And as long as you're identified with your individual level, the step of evolution on which you stand, as long as you're identified with that superstress, you are disqualified from understanding the superstresses of another individual standing on another step. So there's no equation at all here. Do unto others who are so constituted as I am myself, as I would like to be done to. That's the real thing. But you don't know any other individual being who is identical with your own individual being if you are identified with it. And consequently, you are totally disqualified from applying the rules that fit yourself to another being. This means you can't legitimately try to accelerate any other being if you are identified with your own finite evolutionary process. If you do want to accelerate them, first of all, you must go east. Discover the absolute in yourself, Mr. Neely phrased this very amicably, and then go to the absolute in the other person. And when you get to it, that absolute doesn't need accelerating, because it isn't in the time process. And acceleration is a concept referring to the time process. So if you deal from absolute center to absolute center, then you have no ground whatever for trying to accelerate another person. But, dialectically, as soon as you do that thing, then from their centre to your centre comes an absolute reply. You are not hurrying, and therefore I will hurry up in relation to you. Now, we know that to every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction in the field of forces. And therefore, if you apply a contingent stimulus to any being, whatever, on the outside, it must reply by a reaction, must hit you. It's not a one-way street to be driven up. It's a reciprocal relation. You may start it, or you may think you started it. But when you do, there's a rocking process, and your own intent is modified by the reaction of the person receiving it. So we have to interpret this do unto others thing in the following manner. If you can find any others that are identical with yourself in all their parts, and if you know the particular superstresses resting on them at any particular cross-section of time at which you yourself stand, and if you know all the subsequent stimulus situations that are going to arise in them through the contingent stimuli hitting them when you've left, then you can start the acceleration process. Now that's a bit of a tall order. It's a low road that takes a long time. The scientists are trying to do it. Like those Bristol medical men who are drilling holes in people's brains and putting gold wires in and running currents through them in various directions. They're trying to locate something. But the process that they are using interferes with the thing they're trying to examine. They are getting readings from their own instruments and confusing these with the brain's natural responses, and certainly confusing it with something they're not aware of, namely the field in which this brain was involved in the first place. So that the resultants of their experiments are falsified by the nature of the experiment and cannot lead to the truth that they're trying to find. So very simply we can say, if there is an absolute A outside another A, and if one of these A's understands the totality of its A being, and of the other A being, plus the contingent stimuli to which that other A being is being subjected, and therefore the probable reactions of the A being to all the other beings, only then is he right to give a contingent stimulus to accelerate the other being.
The implication is exactly
this, that if inconsistent people are trying to be moral, the best thing for them to do is examine themselves very carefully and see where they're trying to go. And if they have discovered who they are, what they are, what their purpose is, then they should deal with other beings of a like nature in the same way. It's a very broad statement, but it's a very detailed statement in application. It says, in effect, examine yourself first to see what kind of being you are, and then, if you can find any other beings like you, treat them in the same way. Not in the contingent stimulus. So it forces you to the level of seeking an absolute center. You have to penetrate beyond the behavior patterns of people to the self behind the behavior. And immediately you come into the realm of mercy and mutual forgiveness. From your center, you will say to another center, I know that the contingent relations between us are pretty horrid. And these contingent relations and the disrupting stimuli resulting from are seen by both centers to be contingent, temporal, non-eternal, and therefore of no importance whatever, absolutely. So they can actually forgive an apparently profound disagreement in the temporal zone and say this is in the temporal zone and we're not interested in the difference. So that if you have a certain bad habit, and it's very difficult to eliminate it because of the mass inertia that you are training in the body, but you recognize it as a bad habit. And if you have a charming partner who says, no, you have a bad habit, instead of getting annoyed and denying it, you should say, yes, I have. Thank you for reminding me. Do go on reminding me, because I'd like to get rid of it. Thank you very much. And mean it. Now, this does a very peculiar thing to the other person. Firstly, because it isn't the usual kind of reaction. When a person is accused of a deed X, an automatic thing is either to deny doing it, which is very common and quite foolish when they have done it, or to find extenuating circumstances to explain why they've done it. But if you want to evolve quickly to the center, you just admit that this thing actually occurred and say, yes, it's like that in the world of temporal contingent relations, and it's quite difficult to defeat it because there is mass inertia, the sin of Adam, the weight of biological organic material, and so on. And I appeal to an absolute center to say, have you also not got such a contingent body? Not that I'm condemning it, but I'm asking you if you have got one. Is yours under perfect control? If it is, then you are absolutely aware of my difficulty and forgive me. But if it isn't, you have no ground not to forgive me. And if you can say it with the right tone of voice, you disarm the criticism by forcing the other person back to center. And so if you can practice that forgiveness of sins, that non-reaction that Jesus talked about,
then, unfortunately, you will be heaping coals of fire on people's heads. That is, you will be burning away the rubbish in them on their intellectual centres. Because if you can do this, if you can actually turn the other cheek when you are aggressed again, and at that moment the other person is forced back, because to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. He hits you, he condemns you. You open and absorb the attacking energy. Where does he come to? He doesn't know. Only if it comes back has he gained a victory. And does he feel that he was right to hit you? Because he hits you in order to make a mark. But if you open your doors, the energy goes in, and he sees nothing for it. He literally doesn't know whether he hit you or not. And this causes him to search inside himself again for a more effective weapon. And this search, and the rapidity of it, and the vibration of it, and the friction of it, it's called coals of fire on his head. So that every time you can actually inhibit a reaction when you're accused and open yourself to absorb that energy, you do two things. First, you gain all the energy that was thrown at you is yours. It actually increases your stature, your substantiality of power, and so on. And secondly, you cause a rapid mercurial spin in the other person, trying to think why you didn't react in this way. And as progressively it becomes apparent that you are learning to absorb these attacks and gaining the energy, the other person is becoming less and less effectual in the attack and has to stop the attack because it proves him inefficient. Very, very often he tends to go away and start hitting somebody else to get to know who he is. Remember that we are real only insofar as we relate. So that the person who can absorb an attack becomes, to that extent, unreal to the attacker. It's Peer Gynt and the boy. The boy refuses to objectify himself. And Peer Gynt says, "Show yourself and I will hit you." And the boy gives a voice in the void. And he just says, "I'm not that kind. I don't objectify. And you can't hit me." And Peer Gynt thrashes about, trying to persuade the boy to objectify, which is equivalent to trying to get the boy to define his position exactly so that you can condemn it. Whereas, if boy-like, you open up, take the energy in, Peer Gynt sword, you can translate his name as Stony Crucified Woman, Peer Gynt, and he's throwing these things into the void, and the void is replying formlessly by simply absorbing and refusing to objectify. The whole object is to become absolutely aware as opposed to relatively aware. When you're relatively aware, you are suffering from contingent stimulation and you are reactive at the finite contingent level. If you can make yourself absolutely aware, you become wise instead of merely knowledgeable. And you see the idea presented to you dialectically and simultaneously with it. As you open up, the energy of the idea resonates inside your sphere and plays the data back to you simultaneously from all related concepts, whatever. And his incoming energy has done this work for you and made you wise, but not if you react serially and temporarily. Meanwhile, the non-reaction has thrown this fellow into a mercurial turbine, and his brain is whizzing round rapidly to try to find something even more cutting than the last thing that misfired, and therefore you're actually doing him a service. But it's called heaping coals of fire on his head, and he won't like it, and he'll be on guard, and he'll gradually tend not to attack. Luckily for him, something will drive him to attack something somewhere, so that he'll get his next lesson elsewhere. But he will tend not to get it from you. Now, if he's a positive man with a little concept of in what direction to go, he'll come again deliberately and say something. Because he knows now that there's a good absorber here, so he can afford to say these things. But if he's negative and afraid and got an individual will to power, he won't want to be defeated by this superior being, so he'll go away to an inferior being and hit that one. He will then become involved in another kind of contingent relation of reactivity at the finite level. He could do anything, commit himself into any kind of finite relation. In moments of pink, he can go and put his head on the lady's bosom and so on, and find himself committed to that relation. When he does so, he's going to get his next lesson at a lower level than he needed them. But he'll get it somewhere. So the simple thing about do unto others is simply this. Do unto others as if they were yourself. But in order to do that, you must first know yourself. And let's look at our three-part man again. We have a belly urge, heart feeling, head mediation. There are three men and a coordinator. So that in order to deal with one man, who is the field man, the warrior, the kshatriya, the affirmer of the field, which is the meaning of the word warrior in the Bhagavad Gita, the affirmer of the field. He is fighting the good fight. Not the rubbishy fight, the good fight. He's fighting against all the contingent stimuli that force him into finite identification and knock him off his field awareness. And there are three orders. Sexual titillation here, with food involved with it. Emotional titillations here, you like me, don't you, or I hate you. Ideational ones, you are a Marxist, aren't you, and so on. Now here are three orders of stimuli. The bottom one is a double one, sex and food. The middle one is a double one, liking, disliking. And the top one is a double one of ideas of the right and left. Ideas of the haves and have-nots. In the book Ken showed me tonight, there's a little statement of Blake's. A tear is an intellectual thing. Now, a tear is an emotional thing, but you can't cry unless you've made an intellectual judgment about something. You are crying for some reason. So he said a tear is an intellectual thing. So in each of these three departments, there are three departments, and you get the ninefold man out of it. Because one can think about thinking, think about feeling, think about urges. One can feel about feeling, feel about thinking, feel about urges. One can have an urge to think, an urge to feel, and an urge to have another urge. When we realize this fact, we should deliberately train ourselves to say at all moments of the day, when somebody says something or does something, at what level is this stimulus hitting? Which of the three levels? And as soon as we discover it, say, what are the other two levels got to say about it? And this way we travel up and down the body continuously, always passing across the feeling center. In so doing, feeling is the center of the aesthetic sense, taste, good taste, which means awareness of all the implications instead of some of them. Bad taste is awareness of some of the implications to the exclusion of other essentials. Good taste is awareness of all the essentials. And by driving continuously across the center of feeling, when you're stimulated with ideas, rush into the will and say, what will goes with this idea? This is an idea, I'm a Marxist, but then I must have a will to treat all other men like little machines inside a stateless commune. If the idea is of an extreme right wing, a fascist, I must have an idea that I must treat all other people as if they were in a stated commune with me at the top. As soon as you can find the corresponding will to a given idea, you find that as you look at it, there arises something in the feeling. From the compression of the idea and the urge into the center arises field consciousness. That's real work. It can only be done by forcing the awareness to fly over the threefold being continuously. When you're aware of that in yourself, and you know what yourself is, and then and not before can you start dealing with other selves as if they were yourself. And to start trying to deal with other beings as if they were yourself before you know what yourself is a waste of time. And therefore charity begins at home. Home is where the heart is, so it begins in the center of the field. Points of interest now.
If you've had an unpleasant experience, then is it quite legitimate for you to dole this out to somebody else? They are not identical with you, so you don't know.
No. The whole of what we've just seen here says if you had an unpleasant experience, it is yours. And unless you can find an identical being with yourself, and you can't, then you mustn't know it up.
Even if one could, it wouldn't be an identical experience for them, would it?
If one could, one would be absolute, and so would they be, and then you could. In the absolute stage, you're not identified with any finite. And, as Mr. Neely worked out this week, neither is anybody else for you. So you're dealing with the absolute everywhere. Blake said, I can see a grain of sand is a little man. And all the grains of sand is a little man. And then people thought, well, he's crazy. He can't see legs and arms on those grains of sand. But he never thought he could. He knew that man meant center of evaluation. And every center in the universe, whatever, is an evaluation center. And that is the meaning of man. And a grain of sand is a compacted sentient power. Which has will to be a grain of sand for some mysterious purpose. Probably to irritate oysters. To make pearls. The whole tendency to try to accelerate other people without regard to their wanting to be accelerated depends on the fear of loneliness when you get to heaven. You have literally no other ground to hurry anybody up except that you might get there first and be alone, or even get there first and have to light the campfire and do the cooking when the others come. Hence the vow of the Bodhisattva who has promised on no account to be first. He undertakes to be last in heaven so that when he gets there, certainly the place will be tidied up.
The only safe ground beyond here then would be the movement towards the relief of suffering of the people.
If by suffering you mean passivity, yes.
Is there any other definition for suffering?
Not really. It means underdoing or underbearing. Being underneath the load. If you come unto me, all ye that are laden, is the idea. You've got to be laden in order to subfare, underbear.
This idea of if I had the great chopper, I would hesitate to use it in relation to seeing somebody suffering. I remember you once speaking about a doctor friend of yours who, starting to do a painting, found himself painting Christ being taken down from the cross and said, yes, I see this as my job. Am I really meant to remove men from their crosses if those crosses are their way of developing? So he had a problem momentarily as to whether to act or not to act in his position as a doctor for other beings. Before you could actually make such a decision as to lead a person upon that cross, as soon as you could, you'd have to be through, obviously, their absolute center. This would mean they would be left on the cross anyway, whether you interfered or not. But to me, this seems very negative. If you are in a position of superiority, that is where you can apply mercy in the way we have had it defined here, then you are also an acting being. Then there is a need for action in that position. That is, you positively act towards the relieving of that individual of suffering.
I think that that is a negative statement, that you're acting in order to the need to take away, to negate a negative. It's still a negative.
Would it not be producing a positive?
Not unless you're very careful in the way you did it. It's Supposing a person was suffering and you went to that person and removed them totally from the situation and gave them no information whatever about why they were being removed, they could remain ignorant of how they got into it and what it meant to them. I suppose we take an extreme material case. A man falls in a canal. First you get him out of the canal. And then you give him the philosophy of how not to get into canals. But first you preserve him so that he can listen.
Yes, now then we go into something like the attempt on the part of science to produce something that would combat a virus, actively like a cold. Now, if you had in your power at this moment the result of such a finding, that you could give to the world and say, well, this will eliminate colds forever, you see, would it be a legitimate activity to give that to the world, or would you say colds have a purpose to individuals? Although few people get discovered why they get colds, nevertheless, I will hang on to this discovery. Or would you give it to the world and then, I don't know, there would be a different result than forthcoming, some super cold or infinity cold. Then would you try to teach the world why you had so behaved?
What you're really saying is, would you act blind? Releasing what you believe to be a cure. If you remove one symptom, you might get another symptom.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't know, and therefore you're saying, should I blindly try to eliminate symptoms from the human race? Well, if you could actually see the other symptoms that would occur instead of the one you're eliminating, you might hesitate to use the great chopper against the common cold virus.
Yeah.
And the thing is that you're not trying to act blindly, you're trying to become aware so that you don't act blindly.
Now, what in the case, though, the majority of these people are, you could say they're the blind leading the blind. In the case of the majority of medical science, there's a movement to eliminate the virus diseases, the bacteriological diseases, even the mental diseases.
From outside.
From outside, yes.
That is ignorant.
Yeah.
Without knowing causes.
Yeah.
The two schools of thought. One says, let's find the cause, that means go in. And one says, let's find the symptom and hit it.
Yeah.
What we know about the symptom hitters is they change the symptom form.
Yeah.
To them, the cause is an unknown, and an unknowable, because ultimately, cause means power, and power means field, and field means infinity. So they say, let's find the symptom and hit it. If I can get my name in an encyclopedia with that Fleming equals penicillin, and 1,000 years later people say, what was penicillin? And you say, oh, it was something that they thought at the time would solve the world's problems. Does anybody make it now? No. Only a few cranks who believe in old-fashioned things. But he did get his name in the encyclopedia, and he did get a good job. And that's what he was aiming at. What we find in the field of scientific experimental research is the most fantastic egotism and petty jealousy amongst the discoverers. In every country they claim the invention of the potato or some other thing, which no doubt was quite natural.
But then we say one who is a legitimate searcher to remove suffering. I mean, there must be some of these.
The Schweitzers.
Well, you can name them all around.
What are they really looking for? In what direction? They're either looking inwards towards self-understanding, or they're looking outwards to suppress symptoms.
Oh, let's say from ignorance they're looking outwards to suppress symptoms, yet their motive is a genuine desire to remove the suffering by so doing.
It's possible that it may be. I wouldn't say that it is.
Well, that's just possible.
Supposing a baby gets a bit of grit in its eye.
Yeah.
You remove the grit from the eye because you're identified with the baby's self.
Yeah.
You literally feel uncomfortable when you see it. If you walked away knowing that the baby couldn't get it out and it was inflamed and might blind it, if you walked away, you would feel terrible.
Yeah.
Why? The because you identify them, the life of the baby. That life and your life are the same. That baby life is your life.
Well,
that's what we get. Now, if the baby grows up and comes to the point where it can hit you on the nose, and does so, and immediately afterwards gets grit in its eye, the tendency is not to get it out.
I wouldn't say that this is going to be the end result of why a person would take grit out of a baby's eye.
He takes it out of the baby's eye because he's identified.
And when well, that said he's identified with the feel. I'll go along with you to say the fact that the baby and you, as a group of grit, are one. Therefore, you're taking the grit out of your own eye.
Yes, that baby's eye is one of your eyes.
You may never see that baby again, or have grit in your own eye again. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, you have done a job. You have universal being in your life.
That's right.
You have removed grit. Yes. Now, this is what I'm getting at. Now, is this therefore not legitimate to state that if we're going to act at all, then action should be in a positive fashion?
Yes.
And therefore, we do what we can within our powers or within our limits to relieve these other beings of grit in their eye.
That's true. But when you do, you normally talk to the baby and say, maybe you've got grit in your eye. Grit has to be taken out of eyes. And when you take it out of eyes, you take it out carefully so that you don't damage the thing you're taking it out of.
Yes.
And if you omit to say these things to the baby might get a piece of sackcloth, and at school see another baby with a grit in his eye, and proceed to wipe the sackcloth over the ball of the eye, like Danny did, and do a lot of damage. So you explain why you are eliminating this thing. And only if you do that are you really doing a service that will not hit back and destroy as much as it cured. You must explain. When you take the man out of the canal, it's an opportunity to say something to him about causes. What you're doing in the canal is at the right place. Are you a murmur? No, we examine your legs, they're not fish tail. Therefore, it's not your proper habitat. And in good humor, you say, canals are not the best place for human beings to be living in. And you say it lightheartedly, and it goes in because the fellow's half unconscious. And it engrams in him then that canals are not the best place for men to be in. Now you've done him a service of a psychological order, and the physical thing has been an opportunity to do that higher order thing. But if you were to eliminate all the physical troubles without using them as opportunities to make them more conscious, you would do them no service at all.
This is going to eliminate an awful lot of individuals from doing anything other than harm, isn't it?
No. In a way. And Tom, because they have no control over themselves, and they will continue doing good deeds for their own benefit for countless years to come. It will eliminate nothing.
By eliminate, I mean there are not that many people, not many beings, who could, in diverse situations, give reasons as to why they have helped relieve that individual from that, other than the fact they don't like to see or feel or participate in the suffering of the being.
That's all right. He's perfectly at his own level. If a down-and-out rescues a known millionaire from the canal and pretends he doesn't know who it is, that's his business. Yeah. His motive is his own, and his fruit of his action is his own. And he will suffer the consequences of his inner motive as well as of his external activity. When he does something with an impulse, a feeling results in other people as well as himself, and ideas result in other people as well as himself, and he has to pay the price of being an occasion of the introduction of a new force into the temporal world. There will be reaction to the threefold order. Certainly you should do as much as possible to relieve stupid, unnecessary suffering, but never without taking the opportunity of making sure that the person is aware of it in such a way that they can do something about it better next time.
Yes.
Otherwise, rescuing in the material sense is almost a committal to a worse thing next time. Take an example in the case of VD. They advertise a certain cure. And what happened? All youth rushed out. It's a great fact that in many of the hospitals, they were so queued up, immediately after they made this stupid announcement, There were so few that they had to start jabbing the needles very hard to make it painful, to discourage them. You remember Bishop Spelman in New York at the time? Said, I would rather have a moral man with VD than an immoral man without it. See? Because factually, egotism would, if it could, and strives, to the best of its ability, to protect itself against all harm to itself while it's busy pursuing and inflicting harm on everybody else. And so if you say to that individual, oh, you're suffering, you've got a split skull, how did you get it? Oh, I was busy doing something naughty. He said, never mind, I'll mend your skull. So you learned it again. Christ always said, I'll mend your skull and go and sin no more. On one occasion during the war, I found a horrible noise issuing from a corner of Piccadilly in the blackout. I had a torch with me and there were two men struggling on the ground. I flashed it on, and one of them had his eyeball on his cheek. And the cheek was cut with a ring there, and another man was on his chest and was busy slamming at it, trying to make sure it came out completely. So I spoke very gruffly to him and grabbed him by the collar and pretended to be a policeman behind him. And I deliberately jerked him very hard and shouted at him, and then let go of loose grip, and he ran in the dark. And he'd had his lesson, somebody had caught him. There was the other fellow on the ground, and I looked at him and said, what have you been doing to deserve this? And he said, he thought I'd been with his wife. So I said, well, go to the hospital as quickly as possible and get stitched to him, that thing. And so he went. Now, it was no good saying to that fellow on the ground, oh, poor fellow, the wicked beast. There was an opportunity there. What have you been doing to deserve this? It could have been nothing. And in this case, it was something. If he'd have said nothing, he'd say, well, the world is like that. You can have nothing sometimes for something, and sometimes you can have something for nothing. This is one of the occasions. And that makes him aware of the elastic possibilities of relation.
So you take a situation like child there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not going to be much consolation to a woman suffering pain to say, what have you been doing? I mean, you know what you've been doing. Saying you put yourself in a position, would you help to relieve the pain of that suffering?
If a woman is having contractions during delivering a child, I say to her, if you relax, you will feel less pain. In order to relax, if you breathe slowly, you're more likely to relax. Count 4 seconds in and 4 out. Concentrate on your breathing and you will start to relax. This for you. At that moment, I would not lecture on moral issues for another reason. The baby would have every word I said ingrained in him. Might think poor little thing that itself was immoral or naughty or suffering legitimately contractions which were not itself.
Well, of course, I mean, you might have also wanted a child. It was just a natural way of producing children.
The point is that each person acts according to his level of knowledge and will. These two are quite different things. Knowledge and will, the absolute basic power of will, and the form of the modification superset, and the wisdom, the totality of those. But each person is at a certain level, and he does what he can. If he wills to.
Now, what of the man who is immobilized because of his not knowing? Say he said, all right, I recognize my ignorance. I will not give him the cure for the common cold because something else might arise. Is he not suddenly immobilized? Has he not reached a stasis in himself by being at a certain level of understanding?
He may have, it depends how you're looking at it.
Well, this is what I'm saying. Either you're going to have a concept which enables you to positively act in a situation towards relieving suffering if it's within your possibilities, or you're going to be suddenly immobilized by saying, if I remove this individual, the grip from this baby, the pain from this woman, the cold from this one, what else can occur? And you look and you say, so be it, and go the other way.
Yes, but then you'd be wrong, wouldn't you? Because you'd allow the negative to interfere with all your positives.
No, this is what I'm getting at.
You are
in so far
as our text for the day says, do unto others.
Yeah.
In so far as you know yourself, it is legitimate for you to behave to others in like manner.
Yeah.
In so far as you know yourself. If you know yourself relatively well in a certain field, and say, I don't like lying about in canals under the water. I know myself that well. So if I see another of my body, which is what it is,
yeah,
in the canal, I take it out because it's not
an
amphibian, and it's not a water creature. It likes breathing out in the air better. And so I bring the thing out. That is a body that belongs on the bank.
Well, do anybody like suffering, any audience? This would then rather refute the earlier statement, because I don't know anyone who really enjoys suffering unless they're masochistic or something. So really, any suffering with which you identify and say, good greatness, this is suffering. this jumps down to a dog, let alone me. Mm-hmm. I'll do what suffering. I can, really.
Yeah. Well, that's quite legitimate within the meaning of yourself. Yeah. If you understand the thing about your own tissue, that it doesn't like suffering and pain,
then
obviously if you don't like suffering, you must not like having been suffering.
Yeah.
And if you say to yourself, I know that suffering is good for me, and you're absolutely sincere, then you could allow another body to suffer. But you would also say this, I know that suffering is good for me, providing at the end of it I'm able to assimilate the significance and have managed to remain intact to do so. So another person who is suffering, you keep a sharp eye on him so that he didn't expire in the middle of the suffering without having taken the lesson with him. The whole thing is simply a question. These are all bodies within one field. They all belong to the field. They live, move, and have their being in the field. And the field is the father. And that father is the generator and the sustainer and the creator and the formulator. Himself. And he's going to bring all these beings up to their optimum level. And he, this field, is determined to do so for all of them. So if you identify with that field,